government officials to lobby for them. They fund think tanks. They serve on government commissions that make policy. So this is either a clash of the titans or, as often happens, they'll just push the budget high enough to fund both of them. And so
we just have 30 seconds. If you could respond on China.
Yes. Well, China is the gift that keeps on giving. Exaggerating the threat from China is a way to fund these companies. I mean, it's basically in Washington, we say China, you know, that's another $1 billion for a weapons contract. In fact, we should have an accommodation with China, not be preparing for a war with China.
We're going to leave it there. And I want to thank you so much for joining us, Bill Hartung, Senior Research Fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. We'll link to your piece at Forbes. Does America really need a $1 trillion Pentagon budget? Special thanks to our local production crew here at Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana. I want to thank Elvin Cesario, Ben Caldwell, and Tegan Chandler. And special thanks to Corey Olenkamp, to Dean Kristen McAuliffe, and to Kim McClure, as well as Dennis Moynihan. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Werner, Trina Nadura, Sam Malkoff, Tamer Yasti, Joe John Hamilton, Ravi Karen, Hani Masood, Anjali Kamat, Safwat Nazal. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago and here in Muncie, Indiana.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4. Now through April 15, you will hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our talented programmers that make KBOO, KBOO. If you'd like to listen to all the fabulous specials, go to KBOO.fm/ATNF4.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the ACLU calls for an investigation into Portland police for alleged intimidation of city councilors.
Crisis intervention program Cahoots closes shop in Eugene.
And the southern resident orca J-Pod welcomes a new baby calf.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 9th, 2025. I'm Sherry Meredith.
And I'm Josh Salem. The American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU of Oregon, and 13 other organizations are calling on Portland leadership to investigate allegations of intimidation and retaliation by Portland police. In recent weeks, Portland police have shown up unannounced to community forums held by Councilors Angelito Murillo and Samir Canal. The officers didn't tell the counselors they'd be coming or participate in conversation, despite Police Chief Bob Day saying they were there to engage with the community. Both Canal and Murillo have been vocal advocates for police accountability. The incidents at the town halls happened soon after Canal introduced language tweaking the definition of bias against police for the new accountability board. Here's what Chief Day told City Council when asked about it in late March with Councilor Murillo's response.
Cops are people too. They stand around, they see somebody they haven't seen in a while, they get to visiting and lose track of time. I mean, you know, that's just reality. I think this speaks to, I know this isn't part of the question, but I think it speaks to the number of officers who were at Councilor Canal's public meeting. You know, we had five officers show up. That wasn't my direction, that wasn't my expectation. I wanted a couple officers to come by so they can hear from you and hear from the, you know, the community. But also then other officers heard and said, oh, well, they're going to check this out. I'm going to go with them, kind of a deal. And one of the things that I'm learning in this process is to be more deliberate, to be more intentional about the direction that we give and the expectation we set. So the sergeants and the officers on scene certainly have that discretion. I'm always going to defer to them. But then afterwards, be able to have the conversation, which, like I said, Commander Hughes has had, and I would encourage us to follow up with him. I can get you whatever you need the details of.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I think, you know, for our town halls, because I think that happened to, well, I didn't, I don't think it did happen to me as well, with two officers that showed up. Hughes has always been lovely to me when I was campaigning. He came up to me at an event, shook my hand, was very friendly, made sure that I felt comfortable. That's not really what happened with the officers that showed up at my town hall. And so I think that there's a different feeling, and I'm very aware of what's happening. Maybe there's an intention impact aspect to it, but I'm also not stupid, and I see what's happening with my own eyes, and I trust the evidence of my own eyes, because I know the difference when someone is doing community policing.
The letter was written by the ACLU and was signed by 13 other organizations, including Don't Shoot Portland, Imagine Black, Apano, and the Urban League. It reads in part, quote, "Given the timing of events and other information set out above, the logical question is whether Portland police or their union were trying to intimidate and bully city councilors from pursuing police accountability efforts for our city," end quote. The letter calls on Portland city leadership to investigate these incidents to provide accountability and to prevent intimidation and retaliation by police in the future.
The nationally recognized crisis response CAHOOTS program in Eugene has been cut in a budget crunch. CAHOOTS stands for Crisis Assistance Helping Out on the Streets, and it was the model for other successful programs like Portland Street Response. The program sends social workers and medics out to non-criminal, non-emergency calls that involve mental health or mental illness, substance abuse, and homelessness instead of the police. The city of Eugene and the CAHOOTS parent nonprofit, Whitebird, say there isn't money to sustain the program and laid off 7 staff. CAHOOTS responded to over 16,000 calls last year. Lane County does offer a mobile service team, but they have limited hours and cannot do things like first aid care, welfare checks, and housing-related interventions. CAHOOTS remains operational in neighboring Springfield. Whitebird and Eugene say they look for funding. They'll look for funding to bring back the landmark program in the future.
Oaks Bottom Wildlife Refuge in Portland is facing challenges from an amusement park and a planned apartment complex. The 160-acre refuge is home to over 100 species of birds, a couple of dozen different types of mammals, and around 350 vascular plants. Neighboring Oaks Amusement Park received a permit last month for a 135-foot-tall drop tower ride. The tower requires 2 zoning changes, one for structure height, which is 30 feet maximum, and for lighting. The extra lighting could be a major problem for birds and other wildlife in the refuge. Looming even higher over that refuge will be Sulwood Bluff, a new building at the corner of Southeast Milwaukee Avenue and Ellis Street. Set right on the edge of Oaks Bottom Bluff, the building would be nearly 200,000 square feet, 7 stories high, with 243 units of housing and on-site parking. Some have criticized the project, pointing to the instability of the ground it's built on, to the addition of that many people, and to all those windows being near all those birds. Neighborhood activists complained the building's massive design looks like a battleship.
Oregon has earned a number 9 ranking on this year's Energy Efficient Scorecard. The scorecard highlights the state's building codes and efforts to promote equity in energy savings. Isabel Charlet has the details.
Oregon ranked 9th this year on the State Energy Efficiency Scorecard. The American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, a nonprofit research organization, ranks states based on their latest policy developments and efforts to save energy. This year's scorecard highlights Oregon's performance standard for large commercial buildings and efforts to upgrade existing buildings. Jennifer Kales from the Oregon Department of Energy says even though the state's energy demands continue to increase with the population, Oregon's per capita energy consumption is down.
So while we may have more people in our state, we're using less energy per person thanks to efficiency and conservation efforts.
Oregon also scored points for zero emission vehicle policies, including EV rebates and emission standards. Energy Trust of Oregon, a nonprofit that helps people save energy by making their homes more efficient, was recognized in the scorecard for promoting equity. Energy Trust's Julianne Thatcher says they are designing programs that meet the needs of utility households in rural areas, those with low and moderate incomes, communities of color, and small businesses.
For the state to save more energy going forward and meet its climate goals, we need everyone to be able to directly participate in our programs and benefit from lower energy bills.
The Trump administration has paused key Biden-era funding, including the Inflation Reduction Act, which supports investments in energy efficiency, clean energy, and electric vehicle manufacturing. Kayla says for now, Oregon's federal funding is still available, and the DOE's energy efficiency programs will continue despite the uncertainty. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
The acting commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service is resigning because of a plan to share immigrants' tax data with ICE in order to identify and deport people illegally in the U.S. Melanie Krause served in the role since February. Now, she's stepping down over a data-sharing document that was signed yesterday by Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem. That agreement will allow ICE to submit names and addresses of immigrants allegedly residing inside the U.S. illegally to the IRS for cross-verification against tax records. The info-sharing agreement is part of Trump's crackdown on immigration. The IRS has already been in upheaval over Trump administration decisions to share taxpayer data. This is the second IRS director to resign over the administration's meddling in taxpayer data. Opponents say the information sharing agreement violates privacy laws and diminishes the privacy of all Americans. Experts say disclosing immigrant tax records to the DHS for immigration enforcement will discourage tax compliance among immigrant communities, weaken contributions to essential public programs, and increase burdens on both U.S. citizens and non-immigrant taxpayers. It may also set a dangerous precedent for data privacy abuse in other federal programs. The NYU Tax Law Center wrote earlier this week that the agreement, quote, threatens to violate the rights that many more Americans have under longstanding laws that protect their tax information from wrongful disclosure or dissemination. IRS officials who sign off on data sharing under these circumstances risk breaking the law, which could result in criminal and civil sanctions, end quote.
President Trump has pulled back most of the tariff increases that went into effect just after midnight. That's after global markets plummeted after his initial tariff announcement, which covered more than 180 countries. 90 of those were going to be under reciprocal tariffs up to 50%. The notable exception, in Trump's own words, was, quote, based on the lack of respect that China has shown to the world's markets, I am hereby raising the tariff charge to China by the United States of America to 125%, effective immediately, end quote. Wall Street and global markets surged when Trump announced the tariff pause. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent claimed that was Trump's plan all along, though White House officials, including him, denied for days that that tariffs would be suspended. White House trade advisor Peter Navarro said the U.S. will negotiate tariffs with those countries who, quote, who have come to us over the next 3 months. With the exception of China, Trump's tariffs on most countries remains at 10%.
The North Carolina Supreme Court pauses a purge of legally cast ballots. Labor unions protest student visas lost over protesting. And Texas lawmakers want proof of citizenship for both new and existing voter registrations. With those stories and more, it's Catherine Carley with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I worry if what my opponent seeks here in North Carolina happens, it's like dropping a match in a very dry forest and the wildfire will spread rapidly, and we have to guard against that.
North Carolina Supreme Court Justice Allison Riggs says the foundations of democracy are at risk. 5 months since she narrowly won re-election to the state's high court, her Republican challenger is still suing to disqualify more than 60,000 legitimately cast ballots, which he claims lacked voter ID information. A lower court ruling gave these voters 2 weeks to fix their ballots or have them tossed. The state Supreme Court has paused that order. Labor unions rallied in more than 50 cities against proposed cuts to higher education and a crackdown on international students. University of Massachusetts Boston lecturer Joe Ramsey says it's tough to teach students when they're afraid to speak their minds.
The injury being done to our most vulnerable international immigrant students and workers right now is an injury to all of us. Our ability to know the world so that we can change it and engage it meaningfully.
The State Department has so far revoked around 300 student visas, many for students involved in pro-Palestinian and anti-war activities. The Department of Homeland Security and the IRS have reached an agreement to share information on undocumented taxpayers. Murad Awada with the New York Immigration Coalition says the move threatens the safety of thousands and forces them into the shadows.
The federal government should be expanding pathways to legal status, not punishing people who are doing everything they can to contribute to our economy.
Critics point out that the migrants pay billions in taxes, often without collecting Social Security or other benefits. The Trump administration says the information is essential to public safety and election integrity. The Texas Senate has passed a bill to require proof of citizenship for both new and existing voter registrations. Opponents say it could disenfranchise eligible voters who lack the documents. Republican State Representative Brian Hughes calls it common sense.
Part of the reason for this bill is so we'll have some idea of how many folks are registered to vote or seeking to register to vote, but don't have proof of U.S. citizenship.
The bill would require existing registrations be canceled if a voter's citizenship has not been verified. Election workers could face felony charges if they register a non-citizen. A federal judge has ruled Pennsylvania's requirement that voters handwrite the date on their mail-in ballot's outer envelope violates the First Amendment. And a federal judge has ordered the Trump administration restore access for the Associated Press. AP reporters were banned from the Oval Office and Air Force One after the organization refused to recognize the Gulf of America in its style book. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots about Portland's anti-AI rental price fixing ordinance. Then we'll speak with the organizers of the Portland Panorama Film Festival, which kicks off tomorrow. At 6, it's Radio Zine. We'll tune in to a recent town hall held by Oregon U.S. Representative Andrea Salinas. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 46 degrees. Tomorrow's weather, there's a chance of rain with a high of 66 degrees. Today in history, in 1947, the journey of reconciliation begins. It was the first interracial freedom ride through the Upper South in violation of Jim Crow laws. The riders wanted enforcement of the U.S. United States Supreme Court 1946 Irene Morgan decision that banned racial segregation in interstate travel. The quote of the day is from American satirist Tom Lehrer. who said, quote, "I'm sure we all agree that we ought to love one another, and I know there are people in the world who do not love their fellow human beings, and I hate people like that."
The president of the Navajo Nation attending the signing ceremony for Trump's executive officer booking the coal industry. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Navajo Nation President Boone Igren is supporting President Trump's orders to boost the coal industry. Trump held a signing ceremony Tuesday in Washington, D.C., where Nigren was in attendance. In a statement, Nigren said he wants to emphasize the importance of including tribal nations like the Navajo Nation in this national conversation. The orders are aimed at reversing policies that have transitioned the country away from coal production. The Seletz News in Oregon reports that longtime tribal chair Dolores Pigsley was recently honored by the Indian Gaming Association at the 29th annual National Indian Women Supporting Each Other Luncheon in Washington, D.C. Pigsley was recognized for her nearly four decades of serving as chairwoman of the Confederated Tribes of Seletz Indians. In those years, she helped her tribe get federally reinstated. And more recently, she helped her people get their rights to harvest, fish, and hunt on their traditional lands again after 45 years. In a recent interview, Pigsley shared her happiness at negating the consent decree.
It is probably one of the most, since I've been on the tribal council, after restoration, I was on when the tribe was restored in 77. And the next one was when we built our casino and got the land in trust in Lincoln City. And this one is right up there with those.
The youngest of eight children, Pigsley credits her success with having strong mentors and friends, including others on the Seletz Tribal Council. The 8th Annual Traditional Games was held in Juneau, Alaska over the weekend. More than 250 athletes from 30 teams across the state, the lower 48, and Canada competed in a dozen different events rooted in Alaska Native values. KTOO's Clarice Larson was there and has this report.
18-year-old Matthew Chugluk of Anchorage sits low on the gym floor at Juneau Douglas High School Yada'akathle Saturday morning. His neck is craned upward and his eyes are laser focused on a ball hanging on a string above him. Then, in one fluid motion, he kicks a leg up to touch the ball while bouncing on one hand, successfully completing an Alaskan high kick.
By showing grace in your events is by showing respect for not only the event, but yourself too.
Chugluk is Yupik, and he's one of more than 250 athletes who came to Juneau to compete in the 8th Annual Traditional Games. Many of them are Indigenous, but the games are open to participants from any background. The event opened with a cultural dance and song. Throughout the three-day event, the athletes from about 30 different teams competed in a dozen different games. They're all rooted in Indigenous hunting and survival skills.
The history goes back hundreds, maybe thousands of years, so let's see it continue hundreds or thousands of more years.
That's Kyle Worrell. He's a coach and leads the program in Juneau.
It's a way to celebrate our culture and carry on these games and introduce them to youth throughout the Southeast region and beyond.
Nathan Blake is a high school senior in Juneau. Not only did he compete, but he was also in charge of getting the crowd of family, friends, and spectators excited. He says the inclusiveness of the games is one of the biggest reasons he's drawn to them.
This isn't just a game for one culture and one only. This is a game for everyone to come together and just be one with one another, regardless of how you look or what you do.
This year, athletes broke 12 records in different categories and age groups.
That was Clarice Larson, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Millions of Americans could be affected by the Social Security Administration's decision to stop allowing people to apply for benefits or make banking changes over the phone. It begins next week and is raising concerns about what could happen next. Judith Ruiz Branch has more in Wisconsin.
In less than a week, many Wisconsinites won't be able to apply for Social Security benefits over the phone, which could lead to potential disruptions and challenges for millions as the nationwide change takes effect. Starting April 14th, seniors applying for retirement benefits or making direct deposit changes must do so online or in person at an SSA office as part of a new identity verification process. The change comes in haste from the White House amid massive federal budget cuts that have already trimmed staff and resources at the agency. Jim Flaherty with AARP Wisconsin says calls to AARP's national call center have more than doubled in the last 2 months.
They're concerned and they're confused. And it is up to our president and our Congress to work in a bipartisan manner. This is not a partisan issue. They need to work together to make sure that this program remains strong and solvent for current and future generations.
People can qualify for Social Security benefits through retirement, disability, or as a family member of someone who is eligible. More than 1.3 million Wisconsinites receive Social Security benefits. For now, those applying for disability, SSI, and Medicare can continue to do so by phone. There's also confusion about Social Security Administration office closures, which the agency said have been falsely reported, but cuts to resources and services disproportionately affect rural and tribal communities. About 1 in 5 Wisconsinites would have to drive at least 46 miles from their home to the nearest Social Security office, while nearly half would have to drive at least 23 miles, according to the Urban Institute. Flaherty says for some, it's more than an inconvenience.
For a lot of folks, Social Security makes up the majority of their retirement income. Cuts to the program and services could be devastating for them. These are folks who are struggling just to pay their rent or mortgage and put food on the table.
While the Trump administration has said it will protect Social Security and the changes are meant to address fraud and increase efficiency, Flaherty says folks are understandably anxious about what could happen next.
This is a very tough and serious situation that we want folks to be aware of. And this is the time to call your members of Congress and say, hey, you've got to do something before this April 14th deadline to extend this, because it would be devastating for so many folks.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch.
A new orca calf has been spotted with the J-Pod in the Puget Sound in Washington, likely just a few days old. The Center for Whale Research called it a, quote, sign of hope for the southern resident orcas. It's the first calf for orca J40, nicknamed Suttles. That's promising, researchers say. It's good for the whale population when female whales start reproducing. Southern resident orca populations have not rebounded as researchers have hoped due to pollution, a lack of Chinook salmon, and boat noise. According to the Orca Conservancy, Suttles is a famous babysitter who is taking care of a lot of different orcas in the pod. Her new baby is called J63, and researchers will be watching for the calf to gain weight and eventually start socializing with other young whales and babysitters. The baby's gender isn't known yet, and it doesn't have a nickname assigned. The first year of a baby's life is the most challenging, especially for first-time orca moms. But the researchers say they're, quote, cautiously optimistic about J63's survival.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael has never been comfortable gambling.
And they raised back. It's high-stakes global poker, no limits, no agreement on what's wild, with a lot more than cash on the line. I hope one of the chips doesn't fall on me. Trump thinks it's his casino and he's the dealer. Globally, intellectually, psychologically, he's playing with a fraction of a deck, and our America is the stake he's doubling down with. As you can tell from my poetry, I'd be a terrible poker player. And what when the game changes from poker to chess, risk, or mutually assured destruction? Can we get enough billionaires worried about Trump's instability to influence enough Republicans to get the federal government closer to sanity and serving most of the people? Is 2026, when elections could give new Democrats control of House and Senate, too late? Or are we headed toward a time when a military coup might be the most democratic move? Am I bluffing? For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 9th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our producer team for tonight's newscast includes Lexis Ponce, Josh Salem, Hannah Francis, and Dan Raphael. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodewell. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Judith Ruiz Branch, Carolyn Carley, Antonio Gonzalez. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sherry Meredith.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We're speaking with Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots about Portland's proposed anti-AI rental price-fixing ordinance.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, to talk about his latest story for the paper. It's called City Hall Real Estate Investors Fight Over Portland Anti-Price Fixing Ordinance. Renters have more power at City Hall under Portland's new government structure, rankling real estate developers and lobbyists. Welcome to the show, Jeremiah.
Hi, Althea. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. To get us started, let's talk about the Portland ordinance at the center of the hullabaloo, the anti-rent fixing ordinance that was introduced by Councillor Angelita Murillo. What does this ordinance do?